We're starting off with something a little bit different this morning because we're joined on the line by Eric Donovan, a Thai boxer, a former boxer, shall we call him now. Good morning to you, Eric.
Good morning. How's things?
Good, good. You announced your retirement over the weekend at the age of 35, going out on a high after that victory now a couple of weeks ago. Tell us why you came to that decision, Eric.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm 37, but...
37, right.
Yeah, but I'll take 35 if you're giving it to me. No, I just feel there's a sense of completion, you know, mission complete. And, you know, it is a tough sport. It's one of the toughest sports in the world, professional boxing. And it's taken its toll on my body over the last while. And I just feel like my last fight... the European title, that was always my mission, it was always my goal. Never knew if I'd get there, but never stopped believing in myself. I never stopped believing that I would one day, but obviously there is no guarantee you know, that you'll reach these goals, but it never stopped me from getting up every day and trying to make it happen, make it become a reality. And then, you know, that dream came true for me on the 24th of September, and I just feel like that night had everything. It was special. It was perfect. It was live TV. It was a 12-round battle. It ebbed and flowed. I had to dig down to the soles of my boots. I learned that, you know, it was one of those performances where I needed to draw on every bit of life experience I had. And my family was there. My wife was there. My children. Everybody that was important to me were there. And I just feel that we can't top that fight, you know, we can't top that night. And what a way to bow out, you know, at the top. I just thought, mission complete, and, you know, let's move on to the next chapter.
I watched that fight against Khalil El-Hadri, and yeah, it was a grueling 12-round contest. And I know that after, you described it as being the crowning moment in your career. And yeah, even looking at you afterwards, you know, you looked as if you had given it absolutely everything. And as you say, you're not going to top it.
No, definitely not. I couldn't have given any more. I just emptied that tank. I went to a very dark place during the fight. There was a couple of times in the fight where it looked like, and people watching on, boxing people respect their opinions, and they thought, like, you know, at one stage I might be stopped, you know, but then I found this new energy, I found a new resilience inside me, and just, you know, it's the kind of mantra that I beat anywhere through life when I do my talks, and I'm an advocate for mental health and well-being. And, you know, over the last number of years, I've been talking the talk, but, you know, people will know now that I walk the walk as well, you know. And it was so important for me to kind of get to that, to reach that goal, you know, for many reasons. But one of them is, you know, that, you know, we could, you know, I am proof, you know, to anybody out there that's struggling or going through a tough time, find themselves just, you know, life not being kind to them, and just find themselves in a really dark place, you know, that it will pass. You know, if we can continue putting one foot in front of the next, we can get ourselves out of any hole that we're in. And that was it, you know. So for me, it was that crowning moment, and I don't need to push my luck in this game. You know, this is the kind of game where it's, you know, you can be, you know, in the space of, like, you know, in the space of like a couple of seconds, you could be reaching for glory, or you could be on your backside counted out, you know. And that's the nature of the sport. So I'm just so, so grateful and happy after a couple of tough defeats, tough losses, that I can finally, you know, walk away after my greatest night in the game. And I went back into the professional boxing, would you believe, with a load of regrets, because I felt like I really slipped up and failed throughout my amateur career. Now, I won a lot, you know. When people hear me talk, and they'll probably say, oh, sure, he won a lot, what's he saying, you know. And but there is a lot that I left behind me, you know, especially the Olympic Games, you know, and probably a world or European medal as well. So I went into the professional game with a load of regrets, and I'm going out of it now with absolutely none. I'm content, I'm happy, and I have peace of mind. And I just think that's a lovely thing, you know.
Just before we let you go then, Eric, to ask what happens next, and I mean that in the immediate sense. I'm sure you'll want to spend some time with Laura and the family there, but also in a professional sense, are you going to maybe look at punditry, coaching, or there's talk about open roles in the IABA now as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what I'm going to do, but I'm not saying that in the kind of sense that I've nothing to do. You know what I mean? I have lots of options, lots of choices, which is really brilliant, it's amazing. But I am just going to spend these next couple of weeks just enjoying these precious moments with Laura and the baby, and Jack and Troy as well, my two eldest sons. They come up to us as much as they possibly can. So, but there is, I'm going to stick around boxing. You know, I work with one of the best young prospects in the country. He's only 21 years old, Jude Gallagher from County Tyrone. He's a candidate for the Tyrone, or for the Paris 24 Olympic Games. So hopefully he can make it there. So I'm working with him. I'd like to be involved in some capacity. Boxing is my passion. It's given me so much in life. I'd like to be able to give back to it. So, and then there's other avenues that I can go down. I still do a lot of talks, health and wellbeing talks, and stuff like that. But I'm conscious that I walked away. Well, I had 1 year left to do my degree in counselling and psychotherapy. I just put that on hold until I went back and did my did this professional chapter of my life, this professional boxing chapter. So I have 1 year left to get my degree. I think I'll fulfil that next year. Maybe I'll enroll in there next year, 2023, and try and get that done, because that would be a big achievement for me. But yeah, look, I don't exactly know, but my options are open.
Great stuff. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure following your career over the last number of years here on KFM. We've always enjoyed talking to you, and you always had a great time for us, even if you had won in the ring or lost in the ring, but more times you won than lost, which is good. Eric Donovan, enjoyed the retirement, and we look forward to seeing what happens next.
I really appreciate it. And can I just say thanks to KFM? You have been absolutely incredible with my career and the coverage all down through the years. And I'm very, very grateful for that. So thanks, guys.
No problem at all. Thanks indeed for joining us this morning, Eric. And loads of messages coming in to us. One from Mickey in Salon saying, Eric is an absolute legend, and I'm aware of the work that he does outside of the ring with young people in Kildare and further afield. Dylan Larkin, who's Ireland's number one boxing fan, wishing the Lily White Lightning, Eric Donovan, the very best of luck in his retirement. And lots more messages coming in that we'll get to in a few moments' time. But Eric Donovan, who announced his retirement over the weekend at the age of 37. Let's get underway with the newspaper review.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie. Kildare
KFM. All right, now, a mother of three whose ex-partner earlier this year was imprisoned for 2 years and 9 months after his assault in the family home left her with life-threatening stab injuries has called for longer jail sentences for anyone convicted of offences involving violence against women. Louise from Athy believes that the imprisonment terms being imposed on offenders for attacking women are too lenient and do not act as a sufficient deterrent. Louise, good morning.
Good morning, Owen. How are you?
I'm good. Now, we'll get into that in a moment and talk about jail terms and sentences in a moment, if you don't mind. But First of all, explain to me what happened and take me back to 2019.
So the night I was attacked, basically I'd been in a relationship with my partner for 4 years, and we had a one-year-old at the time, and I had ended the relationship earlier on that week, and he'd come over to visit his daughter, but he actually went out drinking in the town, and I went down to the pub to him, and he just started to be abusive, and I just left. I went home. He was getting pretty drunk, and I went home, and Keith arrived later on that evening, and I opened the door. He came through the door, and he just looked at me, and I said, what are you doing? He said, do you want me to go back out? And I said, why would you go back out? You know, you drink on you, you're at work in the morning, and your daughter's here. And he said, grand. And he locked the door behind him. He walked to the end of my hallway, and I stood there, and he just looked at me and said, I could stab you, even my mother knows. And of course, I just thought that was such a strange thing to say. And next thing, he ran to the kitchen, grabbed the knife from the drawer, and I ran to the front door to try and get out. But he caught me at the front door and stabbed me in the back 4 times. So obviously when that happened, like I remember screaming, and he pushed me back towards the stairs. And I just thought, I've got to get out, or he's going to kill me. So I just said, Keith, please stop. I love you so much. And he just looked at me and said, what are you after making me do? And I went into, I suppose, survival mode. And I just said, it'll be okay. We'll get an ambulance and it'll be fine. And I suppose I just was trying to get out of there at that point. And so he just said, okay. And we went to the neighbour's house. And I remember just lying there, and I was obviously bleeding very heavily, and I remember thinking, this is it, I'm going to die now. Which it's a bit of a blur, really, but I remember thinking my dad had passed away just not long before that, and I remember thinking, my dad's coming for me. I'm going to die now, that's it. And I don't want to die. And I remember saying, I don't want to die. And Keith was standing there just looking at me. The neighbours didn't know. They were shocked, obviously. At that point, I remembered my daughter was still in the house. So I said, my daughter's still in the house, someone please get her. And Keith went in and grabbed her and came back into the house. And at that point, they had called an ambulance. And I just remember thinking, I can't die. I just can't die. I have to try and hold on. It was obviously horrific. It was horrific. And the ambulance came. I remember being in the ambulance saying to the ambulance driver, just please, just keep telling me that I'm going to be okay. And he was saying, you'll be okay. We'll look after you. But it was horrific. It was awful.
Was there any indication or warning signs, Louise, that maybe this was coming or it was going to boil over to this point? You mentioned that you were in an abusive relationship. How long had that been going on?
It was a 4-year relationship. We had broken up a few times, you know, and we had been abusive before that, but nothing to, like, anywhere near that level. So, yeah, I suppose it's one of the things you never think is going to happen to you. You know, I knew that would be a struggle. Once we broke up, I kind of saw, well, he's going to kind of make my life a misery as much as he can. But I just could not pull up with being in the relationship with him, which is why I ended it. But it's, you know, I now know that, like, it's when you end the relationship is when you're in the most danger. So it's very hard. It's very hard to walk away from that anyway, an abusive relationship, you know, like that. And especially when you have a child with someone. And it's just a very, very hard thing to do. And as I said, there was abuse before that, but I just never thought it would go that far.
In your victim impact statement in court, you said that the 6th of January 2019 was the night that life would change forever for you and your children. You were in the ambulance, you went to hospital that night. What were the extent of your injuries after the assault, Louise?
So I had a punctured lung, broken ribs, one of the wounds went into my liver, did damage to my liver. I had a big gash in my elbow. I suppose when he was stabbing me, he caught my elbow, which probably could have saved my life, because I was told later on that one of the wounds actually was half an inch away from the main artery. It would have killed me. I wouldn't have been here today. So I'm just extremely lucky to be alive, really. But yeah, very serious injuries. And they were, like, you know, they could have been fatal. You know, it was horrific when it happened. And I spent almost a month in hospital. I was in a lot of pain. But there was a lot of trauma afterwards. You know, when I got out of hospital, I remember being afraid to die. When I got out of hospital, I was afraid to live, because every time I went back to my house, I thought, has he got into the house while I was out? I was afraid to leave the house in case he was outside, because Keith was actually released from prison. So he wasn't in prison at that point when I was released from hospital. So I had a lot of flashbacks, nightmares. Yeah, I was just very scared. Anytime I'd hear a noise in the house or anything, I think because he come back to get me. And so, yeah, it was a lot of trauma. And obviously my children were deeply, deeply affected as well by what happened to my whole family was.
That would have impacted you then for around 3 years, Louise, was it? Because you were in the hospital in around January, February of 2019. The court case then didn't happen until 2022. So for those 3 years, were you constantly on edge?
Yeah, there was a lot of times. I mean, sometimes it was worse than others. You know, depended, like, I mean, as I said, if I was in the house on my own, it would be worse. Any time the court case came up or I knew it was coming up, it would get worse. You know, there were times I thought, like, oh, I don't know how to do this. I don't know if I can do this. I just knew it was something that I had to do. But it was just very hard. And it still impacts me to this day. You know, it's not something that's ever gone away. But I have learned, you know, different ways to cope with it. And I've had counselling and went to see, you know, people to help me with that sort of thing. But it's never really gone away completely. And I don't know that it ever will. Very difficult to deal with.
Bearing in mind what you've told us this morning and you've outlined the extent of your injuries, the sentencing then, that day comes around, how many years and months was your partner given in prison?
Originally, he was given 3 years with the last 3 months suspended, so 2 years and 9 months. So I believe there's like a quarter taken off that, you know, automatically. And so he would serve like just over 2 years. That was the original sentence. So he was basically charged with assault causing harm, not attempted murder, not assault causing serious harm, just assault causing harm. So there's a lot of a lesser charge. So there's a maximum of 5 years, which I didn't think was enough, like, for what was done to me. the intention was there to cause me, at least cause me great harm, if not to kill me. And he did. You know, I had very serious injuries. The charge that he was charged with in the fourth place, I think, was just the wrong charge. And I didn't really understand why he didn't get charged with attempted murder or why he didn't get charged with assault causing serious harm. I believe I was told afterwards it was because I didn't have fatal injuries or I didn't, you know, have a physical injury that would be with me for the rest of my life. So, it's yeah, I didn't have any control over that, obviously, you know. So that was the original sentence that he got.
Was that appealed at all?
It was appealed, yeah. The appeal went ahead just yesterday. The DPP felt it was too lenient as well. I wasn't told anything about this process on the day of the sentencing. So they went ahead and appealed. And the DPP agreed that it was too lenient. So it was before the court yesterday. And they agreed that it was too lenient. And so basically what they did was they added another year onto his sentence. So then now the sentence is 4 years with the last 3 months suspended. Yeah, and I believe they couldn't. There wasn't much more they could do because one of the judges did say the problem was with the original charge that he had, there was a maximum of 5 years. And because he had pleaded guilty, he had to get something off that.
My mind goes back to when Aisling Murphy was killed that time, and, you know, there was obviously outrage, and rightly so. And we were reminded of all those names of the women who were murdered in Ireland since 1996. And research found that more than half of the 244 women that were murdered were killed by a partner or an ex-partner. And I note that you were saying as well that you wonder about all the similar incidents that we don't hear about because victims are too afraid to report their partners. And I mentioned this in the introduction that these lenient sentences, as you feel they are, they don't act as a deterrent because they're not long enough jail terms.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, it's a joke. Like, I mean, the system is a problem. I'm not blaming any one individual or, you know, any particular guards or detectives that dealt with me because they were brilliant. But I think the whole system is wrong. I mean, I've heard about so many cases since then, and it makes me so, I mean, I'm heartbroken for those women that this happened to and their families. I mean, I could have been one of them, and I've went through this, and it's absolutely horrific. And to give somebody a sentence of a couple of years for basically what was attempted murder, for what he did, or anyone a lenient sentence, it isn't a deterrent for these men. I mean, if they think they're going to get away with it, then, you know, it isn't. Obviously, it's not going to stop them, and this is going to happen again and again. And I've heard about so many other women that this has happened to, and it's just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because it's so hard to go through this process and to go to court against somebody that you once were in an intimate relationship with and you have a child with maybe. And, you know, to go through that in the first place is very, very difficult. And then, you know, when lenient sentences are given, it doesn't give women, I suppose, the confidence to come forward to know that they are going to be, you know, getting longer sentences.
We're going to give out some helplines in a few moments for people maybe who find themselves in that sort of position and they want to get help. Louise, if somebody listening is experiencing abuse in relationships, as somebody who has been through it, what advice would you give them?
Well, the first thing I would say to them is that you need to realise that it's not your fault. I think a lot of women think that it is their fault if only they were different, you know. But it's not your fault. It's never your fault if you're being abused. So that's the first thing I want women to know. And that there is help that you can get. You can go and get help, you know, from places like Women's Aid, who I remember going to them. They were so good. They're confidential. You know, do report things to the guards. It's not easy to do. But from my point of view, like, you know, obviously it almost cost me my life. Being in that relationship almost cost me my life. And not keeping myself safe when I did leave almost cost me my life. So if you do leave, just please make sure that you keep yourself safe. Don't be alone with that person. And, you know, reach out to people, even if it is hard. And, yeah, keep yourself safe. Get yourself some help.
You mentioned Women's Aid there. The free phone number for Women's Aid is 1800 341 900. That's 1800 341 900. Chuck Terman in Kildare is 045 527 584. That's 045 527 584. And of course, as we know, domestic violence can affect both men and women, so the Men's Aid number is 01 554 3811, 01 554 3811. Louise, before you go, how are you doing now? And I know that the fact that it's all reared its head again now with that DPP appeal over the last few days has kind of brought everything back into light. But How have you been over the course of this year?
I have good days and bad days. I mean, I'm okay in general. I have to be. I'm a man. And you just get on with your life, don't you? You just get on with it. That's the only choice you have. But it is, particularly as you said, the last couple of days and the last week leading up to it was very hard, very emotional. It just brought back a lot of trauma as well. But I'm hoping now, after this, that I just, you know, get on with my life, do the best I can, you know, give our daughter the, you know, the best life that she can have.
Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us this morning, Louise. I know it's not easy to come on and talk about, but it is a very important issue that has to be spoken about. And again, that advice to women and men who find themselves in domestic abuse situations to seek help and realise it's not your fault and that help is out there. Mother of three, Louise from Athy, her ex-partner earlier this year was in prison for 2 years and 9 months. That has since been extended now by a further year after his assault in the family home left her with life-threatening stab injuries. And Louise, I really do appreciate you coming on the programme this morning. Good morning to you, and regards to all the gang there in Athy.
Thank you, Owen.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Thanks once again to everyone sending in the birthday wishes this morning to Helen in Rathangan, to Mary Fisher in Blessington, also Michael in Clane, and Mick Spencer in Kilcullen says happy birthday, Owen, and could you please wish Sean Price in Kilcullen a very happy birthday today as well. And Mick Spencer says he has a few years on you. So Sean Price, happy birthday. Those are Mick Spencer's words now, not mine. So keep that in mind, but glad to hear that we share a birthday. And as always, if you do want to get in touch with the programme, 0833 97 97 97. Now, Ireland has the worst healthcare for transgender people among the 27 EU member states, a European network of more than 200 trans rights organisations has found. Transgender Europe, which is funded by the EU, scored member states on 6 criteria, giving 2 points for every criterion met on their provision of trans-specific healthcare. Tina Colas-Orban is chair of TENAI, the Transgender Equality Network of Ireland, and they're on the line now. Good morning, Tina.
Hi, good morning.
Out of a potential 12 points, Ireland received just 1, and it shows that Ireland have the worst provision behind Slovakia, Hungary, Lithuania and Greece, and pretty far behind Malta, which was found to have the best provision for trans healthcare. Tell us a bit about your reaction to that news.
When I have seen this map, I was literally shocked, because I was aware that gender-affirming healthcare in Ireland is far from perfect. And I could even say, although it's not black and white, that I was aware that it's not good at all. But it was shocking to see for me that Ireland is the worst.
I mentioned there the 6 criteria that this scoring is judged on. What kind of criteria are we talking about here in each country?
Oh, yes, we are talking about type of gender-affirming healthcare and coverage available in the country. That is one of the criteria. Then whether there is a requirement for a psychiatric diagnosis before hormonal treatment or surgery. We also talk about waiting times for first appointment with a professional. That is a point on groups excluded or made to wait longer to access care. And we talk about youngest age for puberty blockers and youngest age for hormones. These are the six categories.
Okay, and Ireland's single point was achieved for the provision of trans healthcare at all. It scored worst on waiting times, having longer delays than any other country at between 2.5 and 10 years from requesting to see a specialist in trans healthcare to seeing one in most other states. The wait is less than a year. So even just looking at that in isolation, Tina, waiting times are extortionate.
Yes, absolutely. I think waiting times are really not good in the country. And it's at the moment officially 3 years, but we know that it will be longer because there are more and more people going for care. And obviously the service is not expanded. So we will see even a bigger increase. And at the moment it's unclear what is the exact waiting time. And just waiting for a first appointment, that's not waiting for care. Mm. That's just a first appointment to see a professional, and care can be far away from that.
Can you tell us about the need to get a psychiatric diagnosis to assess trans-specific healthcare? First of all, why do people who want to transition have to go through a psychiatric diagnosis? And also the fact that the waiting time here in Ireland is around 7 years.
So the psychiatric diagnosis, we believe, should be a thing from the past, because being trans was considered to be a mental health condition by the World Health Organization for decades. And the World Health Organization has removed that diagnosis from the new international classification of diseases 3 years ago. And we would love to see a different approach to trans-specific healthcare, even in Ireland, which has signed up for ICD-11. And we believe that people don't have to be diagnosed for hormone treatment. Informed consent model is the one that we support, where the patient has given all the information to make an informed consent and then can hormonal treatment. And there might be some assessment for surgeries or other type of interventions, but the psychiatric diagnosis nature of the thing is something that is not needed.
It's interesting when you look at how Ireland compares to some of the other countries that I mentioned there in the introduction. Countries in Europe that would be traditionally maybe more conservative than Ireland would be, the likes of Hungary, Slovakia, Lithuania, they all have better provision for people who want to transition than we have here in Ireland. Is that correct?
Yes, according to this map, obviously they have better situations. That can be like many things. So I'm originally from Hungary, and I'm looking forward to have the time to dive into the data, because I think we need to examine this and we need to do everything we can do to move Ireland up in the list. And I believe that the government will be partner with us in that. They might have more care available in their own country, or the waiting time is less, or there is no proof that groups are excluded from care. It can be many things that, I mean, it's not difficult to be better than Ireland.
Okay.
Only toward 1 point.
And Tina, could you just take us maybe quickly through the process then? If so, a person here in Ireland wants to transition, what do they have to do? So say if, for example, and just using this for an example purpose, you have a male, somebody who was born a male, wants to transition to female. What process does that person have to undertake here in this country?
I mean, the process is pretty similar regardless of the sex or gender of the person. They need to go to their GP and they need to be referred to the National Gender Service, where then they are put on the list and they wait 3 to 10 years, whatever the time will be, to wait for one initial assessment, which they call assessment. It's a 4-hour extensive, kind of pretty heavy and deep assessment of the whole life of the person. They have to answer really intrusive questions, which I don't want to say in the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then they might get hormone treatment. And then it goes on. They need to go back and back again to get other type of treatment. But this assessment is really not good for the person.
I'd imagine yourselves at TENI, the Transgender Equality Network in Ireland, would have heard experiences of people who have gone through this system, and I'm sure a large majority of them express anger at how complicated the system is, how long a process it takes. But are we at the risk of turning people away from transitioning because they might see the length of time it takes to get the initial assessment or the psychiatric assessment, etc., and they decide, I'm not going to transition now?
Yes, the big picture is that 1% of the population is transgender anyway. They are not out, and there are not that many visible. We are pretty far from that. And obviously these obstacles stop people from coming out and start their journey to become themselves. Others choose not to go to the National Gender Service, but go to private options because that is faster and that is more kind of human to say it. So there are different options people take, but it's obviously holding people back on their journey.
Okay, well, this is new research that has come out that shows that Ireland is ranked worst for transgender healthcare in Ireland. And if you want to read more, you can check it out online. Transgender Europe, TGEU, which is funded by the EU, has released this colour-coded map showing which countries have the best and worst provision. Malta has the best, Ireland has the worst out of a potential 12 points that they were scored on. Ireland received just one. And with that reaction and analysis to that report, Tina Colas-Orban, Chair of the Transgender Equality Network of Ireland. Tina, thanks for joining us this morning.